Welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 204. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and this is the last you'll hear from me on the entire episode. With me, as always, John Lindemann.
You are my sunshine, my only sunshine, Johnny.
I know.
You make me happy.
Oh, dear.
When skies are gray.
The voice of Darth Vader, James Jones. My favorite line from Star Wars.
How different things would have been if we'd had that attitude.
And, of course, that is Greg Lay.
Oh, hey, hey, everyone.
Our indefatigable editor.
editor.
I disagree entirely. I can tell right now.
If there's one thing I am, it's fatigue.
All right. So we are going to jump into new business here. And Greg starts off with an interesting experience. It's kind of a repeat from last year, I guess. But
that's right.
I bet you were even more excited this time to play the E3 demos a month later.
That's right. Yeah. Very similar to last year. Nintendo held an event in the center of London, this time atop a tower. As opposed to
London Tower?
Pools, this is Millbank Tower. This is sort of one of the taller buildings in the city.
Did you have to fight your way up to the top of it?
I didn't.
That's what it sounds like. It's like the
elevator has mysteriously broken.
It was not like the final level of Final Fight or something where I had to brave falling chandeliers and beat several people to death just to get to the demos.
That would have been a disaster.
But it was definitely a bit of a different ambience looking over the city as opposed to being a poolside, as I was last year. But also they had this year's offerings from E3. Not in total. There were some conspicuous absences like the Zelda Skyward Sword.
Oh, that's too bad.
Quite curious. I have seen substantiated in other outlets that apparently the demo units actually had the Zelda demo loaded on them, and yet we still couldn't play it. So that's very weird to me. But yeah, so no Zelda and a couple of other things that were absent. But they did have, first of all, the 3DS there, sort of maybe about half of the kind of demo things that were probably at E3. I mean, there's certainly not some of the more kind of exotic things like that classic collection.
Exotic, like Steel Diver.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm not able to weigh in on the highly controversial Steel Diver. you know, they're bigging it up. I read something. Reggie was giving an interview the other day, and they were asking him about why Kid Icarus is a flagship title for 3DS and so forth, and he was giving some answers or whatever about, you know, what a deep catalogue of characters they've got. And then after that, he says, well, in one game I'm looking forward to buying is Steel Diver. And I'm like, wait, what, they're going to put that on sale?
You know how I know that's a lie? Because first off, he doesn't have to buy any games.
He just won a bet by saying that.
That's right. There was a bet with other Nintendo execs. I bet you can't make Steel Diver sound good.
He's like, pay up, Iwata. Give me that yen.
Steel Diver is my favorite robotic pimp.
By the way, that one bet is why Nintendo lost money this quarter.
Mm-hmm.
It was all that bet.
Coincidence? I think not.
They did have a lot of the kind of wackier tech demo things like the face.
Face Ace and cat bouncing, yes.
No Pogo Cat, unfortunately. But there was a couple of things. First of all, I think probably the thing that I took away from most in terms of being impressed was Pilot Wings, because that was playable. I got to sort of dabble with the slide pad a bit, which I really like the feel of, actually. It's got that nice sort of resistance to it.
Mm-hmm.
Felt perfectly in control in the 3D space with that. I definitely got the idea of the 3D effect and everything. I mean, you know, even as much as I've heard about 3DS at this point, you know, it feels like in these weeks hence from E3, I've listened to so many podcasts and read so many articles sort of going on about how brilliant it is. You know, it does set the bar a bit high, but there is nothing quite like seeing it in person, obviously. I think what really hit home for me looking at it being displayed is where kind of you've got a, you know, primary object in the game, one of the videos, you know, that you're kind of looking at, and the very different sensation of when you kind of take your focus off that and look elsewhere, it doesn't so much feel as like you're looking to the left of, you know, Pitt as he's soaring around in that Kid Icarus video, but you are kind of looking beyond him. It really, it's kind of subtle thing. Once your eyes kind of get used to it and you muck around with the slider if you have to, it really does work very well. I mean, there wasn't a whole lot of other stuff that was that impressive. So, I mean, the Metal Gear thing they had, and was that it, looks really, that looks very
nice. Was
very,
it the, like, nice. 2.5 hour long one or the short one?
Well, it was definitely a lot longer than everything else.
Well, yeah. They were both longer than everything.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of difficult for me to say.
One took the entire demo time for the DS stations upstairs.
Really?
There was a long one in a corner, apparently, that went on forever.
So it must be a cutscene then, right?
It's part of the game, exactly.
I'm just saying.
I'm curious, having had the benefit of knowing what to expect, because when we all when we saw the 3DS, you know, we had no freaking clue what we were up against.
You know, a lot of people didn't even seem to know precisely what was there until they saw, you know, it was a great mystery as what was actually on show for ages, like these little things like the Classic Collection.
Well, yeah, I mean, I believe we have the only comprehensive list out there of everything that was at E3 on the 3DS, and we did not complete that list until the Tuesday after E3 closed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we just had the sheer manpower.
I mean, yeah.
Our website staff probably spent more time in the 3DS area at E3 than, you know, if you add up all the people and all the time we spent.
The man hours.
I can't imagine anyone else comes close.
And the thing was, they wouldn't tell you either, like, because we asked, you know, this is what we have. What are we missing? And they're like, well, there's stuff all over the place. Go have a look.
In other words, they don't know either.
And we're like, you ass. You work here. Tell us what you have.
I bet they got half those demos in like the day before the show.
Yeah.
They had no idea what was coming in. You know, I mean, did you notice that the girls who were standing next to each 3DS or sitting next to each 3DS unit weren't telling you about the game for the most part because they weren't trained on those specific games?
Later in the week, the ones that had played the games that they were holding were the only times you could tell people who actually played the game, like, oh, yeah,
right,
you need to do this. But you could tell they weren't trained.
Right. And I think that's really telling because in Nintendo's booth, every single year, their booth babes or attendants or whatever you want to call them are usually very well educated on what the game's about, how to play it, what features are in there. You can ask them questions about the game and they'll basically answer that knowledgeably. And in the 3DS area this year, no. They just sat there. You know, they didn't know what
they wiped the screen.
What was going on.
That's it.
Well, it wasn't that chaotic there. It was clearly indicated what everything was.
Oh, no.
So you could just pick off what you wanted to
look
at.
I'm sure there wasn't the insane lines or anything either.
No.
It was nice
again,
and quiet.
It was quiet.
Why do I go to Los Angeles every year? I need to rework this plan. It's not that much
because
farther.
Well, because you wouldn't have got to play Zelda, would you?
I didn't get to play that much anyway.
Well, yeah.
I played it just enough to get an AP photo. That's it.
So, Greg, that's 3DS. What else did you play that you want to
bring
up here?
I'm going to guess you spent an extremely long time with Other M.
Yeah, well, it was by far the longest just because you had to stand or sit there during cutscenes in between games. Like, I mean, I did play some Kirby, DKC. I also saw the DSi XL for the first time.
Oh, that's
I've not
right.
seen this beast in the wild before.
And, that's right.
It was impressive, you know. The
it
3DS,
is impressive.
The 3DS as a physical unit seemed quite underwhelming afterwards.
It did. Was like, first time I saw 3DS, I'm like, that's it.
Tracking the beast in the wild.
Big game hunting. It is an impressive animal. And, you know, they had a bit of a broader smattering of things than the event last year, actually, in terms of having some third-party games. Okami Den, Ghost Trick, Super Scribble Nauts, you know, things like that. They didn't quite have that kind of breadth last year. But, yeah, I mean, with Wii stuff, they also had some third-party things like Epic Mickey and Goldeneye. But definitely I was most interested to check out Nintendo's first-party things, and I enjoyed both Kirby and DKC. Both seemed pretty promising to me. Kirby's kind of interesting, other than obviously it's very beautiful, it's still to be quite open as to precisely what kind of game it's going to be. Clearly,
yes.
You know, it's a kind of thing where, you know, it's not going to be about worrying about Kirby kind of dying.
No.
And it'd be interesting to see, you know, how much it's like the really old school Wario Land games rather than Shake It that Goodfeel actually did, because you could die in that one. Whereas the old school Wario Lands you couldn't, and how sort of puzzly it gets. Because if you're going to go the kind of route where you're not worried about him dying, I mean, perhaps it was just tuned that way for the demo, but then you've got to introduce some sort of interesting kind of aspects to it another way.
I have a lot of faith in those guys, though, based on Shake It.
Some people were not huge fans of Shake It, but I was, so I feel confident, too.
The person demoing it at E3, when I spoke to him, noticing that there's no life bar on this game, I asked him, can you die? And his answer was, not that I've observed. So, that was about as close to an answer as I felt like I was going to
Thank you for
get.
Your expert opinion.
It's like, you've been demoing this game for 3 hours now.
But yeah, I was definitely most intrigued to play Other M, because it's quite near on the horizon now. It's a few weeks away from the game coming out. And of course, there's been a lot of talk about the controls and everything, so quite interested to get hands-on with it and see what I thought of them. And after, seeing through some CG stuff and all that, I finally got to get on with the controls. And as time went on through the demo, I did get to play quite a lot of gameplay. I did get used to them more and started to feel really quite comfortable, and sort of they kind of won me over a bit as it went on. I mean, it's definitely quite odd. It's not so much that the controls are not intuitive in themselves, but they're quite counterintuitive in terms of relative to everything you've played before, to some extent. So it definitely takes some getting used to. And in certain aspects, the whole D-pad in the 3D world thing doesn't really feel out of place, because you're kind of going down these environments that are very corridor-ish. You know, it kind of looks like they perhaps did at one time design some of these levels in a Klonoa kind of way, where you're talking about a polygonal 3D environment, but you'd be going along one plane, and then they've kind of opened it out since, but you're still just going along, very specific directions, and you don't really feel the need for the subtle kind of movement.
But there are certain rooms that are, they're more volumetric.
Yes, there are. And in particular, you've got these bits that are kind of arena battle-y. You get the where you're facing off a few enemies. And this is really where the D-pad becomes as much of an issue as anywhere. I mean, obviously, in terms of shooting, you don't have to worry about it, because it just kind of auto-targets unless you're going into first-person mode. So in that sense, you really don't have to worry too much with enemies, normal enemies. It's kind of like the main thing you only have to do with them is just put some distance between you and them. If as long as there's distance, then you're going to be able, Samus is going to be able to kind of auto-target her way to killing them. And then the one thing that where it really kind of felt a bit off to me, and I was a bit skeptical about the way it would work, is when you're doing things like jumping on enemies and delivering like finishing blows and stuff. Because if you're doing that in 3D space, it's a little more awkward with a D-pad to do. I felt, I was kind of not sure of the wisdom of kind of having that part of it, because obviously normally if you do like third-person combat and stuff, you might have a lock-on feature, analog control, all this different stuff, and they've got things that kind of help you work around that, like for instance the dodge move that there is, where you just do a little tap on the D-pad and Samus will sort of boost out of harm's way and things like that. So you can get into a nice little rhythm with that in terms of dodging and shooting. But when it comes to actually sort of physically getting in there, jumping on top of things and stuff, that's where I'm not sanguine at the prospect of that part of the game being developed.
Maybe you can find an upgrade that lets you use the nunchuck.
Now, how much control do you have over those finishing moves?
It's very simple. It's very simple. It's just context sort of sensitive. For instance, if you've stunned an enemy enough, you can kind of walk up to it, just with the direction on the D-pad and the one button, deliver a finishing blow. Just a very close range charge shot to the face that finishes it off. Quite brutal in its own way.
Are they all random, or does it?
No. I mean, they're not around. They will vary, I think, by opponent as much as anything. You know, the opponent's physiology will probably dictate a lot of that. And so overall, you know, it seems to me like the basics of the controls work all right. You know, the whole going into first person thing, it felt pretty quick. It did, you know, it didn't feel too cumbersome that way. It's certainly a lot quicker than switching to the paintbrush in Okami 10. That was long.
Yes, that's a problem in that DS game.
But and then I kind of sort of got used to things like, for instance, targeting like one of these like hives with enemies coming out of it. And I kind of got used to the idea of like shooting at the enemies with A, just with the standard, but and then once they're cleared out of the way, then you lock on with B and deliver the missile to actually blow up the hive and things like that. So I was getting used to it just as it was kind of finishing. And hopefully some of these boss encounters as the game goes on will really take advantage of the sort of different parts of the gameplay and introduce some kind of puzzle mechanics into it using them, because they always tend to be my favorite parts of Metroid when they're done well.
Well, Aaron Kluska is, I believe, supposed to be going to Nintendo in San Francisco to play a near-final version of Other M in a few days, and there's going to be an embargo, but he should have something about it up on the site, like I think towards the end of the first week of August. So if you really, really want to learn more about Metroid as we get into the final month before it comes out, keep an eye on the website. And of course, we will let you know on Now Playing once that is up.
Yeah. I mean, I think outside of just the basics kind of controls, which is obviously the main thing I took away from it, it definitely has a very Fusion-ish feel to it of all the Metroid games. Even the colour palette, even very bright, very sort of garish almost. Although there is certainly no need to worry about the original GBA screen as a reason for why the colour palette is the way it is. And of course, you know, the story to some extent. And also what appears to be the nature of the environment, and the divided into numbered sectors, and they all kind of, you know, they all sort of simulate different environments and stuff. It's very, very, it looks, at least, you know, just from this sort of opening part of the game, very fusionist. So, I mean, it's not my favourite Metroid game, that one, but I still enjoyed it quite a lot. So, I mean, I can live with that if the gameplay is going to deliver in the long run.
I'd be happy with Metroid Fusion 2, if that's what it is. I'd be totally okay with that.
Kind of Metroid Fusion Naught, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess. It's Metroid 4-0. Yeah. So, James, please tell us about your secret shame.
Well, so the secret shame I discussed last week is still ongoing. Well, that's not particularly secret.
No, it's not.
I marathoned the hell out of Tales of Vesperia so I could get through it and talk about something else this week, like something I would have got to put significant time in. And even after taking a 13-hour game save up to like 47 hours, I still haven't beaten the final boss of the game, and I have not been pouring myself into the many, many, many subquests that come in Tales games. Mm. I've been actively avoiding them. It just doesn't matter.
Are you still watching the party chats or whatever they're called?
Yes. I do have to watch them because sometimes they actually provide information that could be useful.
Did they voice them in this one?
Yeah.
Okay. I know they're typically voiced in the Japanese versions, but with the Symphonia games, they basically said it's not worth the time to localize and re-record voice for these.
Yeah, because there's something like 100 of them in this game. It was a major ordeal to voice them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an ongoing adventure, literally and figuratively. So to sort of break that up, and because for God's sakes, I needed something else to talk about, I took advantage of the GameStop Power Days to indulge in the sport I don't talk about very much on this show, but I actually love quite a bit, and getting the MLB 2K10. Which right now they're selling for $30 off its retail price.
You love all sports, don't you?
Most. I'm not particularly a fan of soccer. It just isn't my thing.
Cricket?
I'm a huge cricket fan.
What about Hi-Li? You into that?
Oh, yeah. Every day.
Miami Knights, hello? Of course he's into Hi-Li.
Exactly. That's all.
James Jones is Miami.
I could just hear the Jan Hammer music playing in my head.
Oh, boy. I enjoyed watching field hockey in high school, but it had nothing to do with the sport in question. So the thing about me and baseball is I really love the sport of baseball, but even then, I get fucking bored watching it. So I can only sit through an entire game if my personal team, which would be Cincinnati, is playing.
Now, what do you love about it? Do you love the stats?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm a numbers guy.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I can't
RPG
stand.
Man makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. As
well, I mean, come on. I have a computer science degree. Of course I love numbers.
I just like to get inside the head of James Jones every once in a while just to kind of...
But I enjoy the game, too. Like, I can enjoy sitting and watching a baseball game, but it's just so slow on television that it's just unwatchable.
Mm-hmm. I had a conversation, and I'll interrupt you very briefly, James, but I had a conversation the other day about the way different sports are presented on TV. And I made the argument that golf is actually a lot more exciting to watch on TV than baseball is, because in golf, they're smart enough to cut out all the parts that are boring, and so they only show you the shots.
Well, it's because they've got all the different players on the court at any one time.
Right. But in baseball, I'm just saying, don't show it live, edit out all the boring stuff, and like you could get those games down to like 45 minutes, and that would be exciting to watch.
I enjoy pitching. I enjoy watching really good pitching, so this year's been like... has really got baseball back up for me. And when games are pitched well, they're also very short, which is a double bonus. Mm. So a game that with like a three hitter is going to be an hour shorter than a game that's like a 12 hitter. So yeah. It makes a huge difference. But I decided to indulge in the only baseball game available for the 360 or Wii, although I got a 360 version, which is 2K10. Which the 2K series apparently has always been kind of like the shit baseball game. And that if you had a PS3, you got The Show, which is the good baseball game.
It's very well-rated, isn't it, The Show?
Yeah. So 2K10 was apparently 2K Sports finally cared. And they made a game that wasn't shit. So I was like, all right, well, let's do this. So for reference, the last baseball game I had was the Griffey N64 game.
Really?
Which wow. I played three entire seasons of.
Wow.
Including one season where I gotten so good at the game, because in reality that game is really easy. That I didn't lose a single fucking game the entire season.
That's realism for you.
Like late in the season, I lost a game. Like, I'm not saving that. I have 100. I'm 105-0. There's no way in hell I'm going to let myself lose a game now.
So James, did you not buy it on any of the Mario baseball games?
No.
And of course, well, the Griffey. I guess they made a couple of them, right?
Yeah, and I think there's only one N64 game. They made I believe there was a GameCube game.
And then they were going to make Pennant Chase baseball, and then that got canceled at the last minute. And
like, it was done and got canceled, weirdly.
Yeah, from everything we've heard, that game's pretty much finished and sitting on a shelf somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yes, never to be seen again.
Right.
The thing about this game is, first off, it integrates really well with the internet, which is cool, because it actually downloaded the current rosters of the teams. So it's 2K10, but obviously rosters have changed since the game came out, because in baseball, rosters change pretty much nonstop.
Which one did LeBron end up going to?
Oh, he went to South Beach, where his talents were needed. No, seriously, his talents are fucking needed with the Marlins. I mean, mm-hmm. God, at least people would go to the games. Florida Marlins, average attendance, 6,000.
Yep.
It's really hard. I mean, this game is really damn hard. So I played the demo, and I'm like, all right, well, this demo is pretty good. I'm sure if I get the game, I'll be able to figure this shit out. I'm like five games into the season. I'm getting smoked every game. So pitching, it's all controlled on the Xbox with the right analog stick. So your pitches, you select them with the face buttons, and then you follow a timed routine on the control stick of managing that pitch. So for like a breaking ball, you'd hold it to the right till the speed was charged up, and then you'd rotate it counterclockwise halfway around. And if you stop on the right place, your pitch is good. If you don't, your pitch is all kinds of jacked up and goes wherever the hell it wants to go. Hmm. So that took forever to figure out, and that's still tricky sometimes. But batting is like, there's no indicator saying you need to swing now. Batting is all managed by either just flicking it forward to do a regular swing, sideways to do safe swings, which means you'll hit them more often, but they're very likely to go foul or not go very far. And then go back and forward to do a power swing. The timing is really, really difficult. And figuring out where the pitch is going to wind up is really difficult. And I will never win 100 games in this particular game. It's just never going to happen. I'm certainly not going to go 162-0.
Well, it's good to hear that the actual way that you play the game has changed since the 10 years since you last played a baseball game.
So it's probably more than that. So the show relies on face buttons to do all this stuff. So I guess it's more realistic, and realistic is kind of a relative statement, to do it with the control stick, because it's more of a challenge to get the stuff right versus just press button to swing bat. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure if that's a good thing. I mean, it definitely is a huge learning curve. So I just finished up a game where I had like 27 hits, which is amazing, except I didn't score any fucking runs because I can't field worth garbage.
27 hits and no runs. I'm not a baseball expert, but that sounds unusual.
That is... let me put it this way. If your team had 27 hits and no runs, the batting coach would have been fired the next day.
What about the base running? That's what a lot of people
it's
doing
so bad. Like, I don't know what the hell is going on. I'm like, I still can't throw to the right bag. It's terrible. I mean, it's taking me so long to learn this game. Which I guess is good. I mean, I guess it means it's deep, but right now it's really fucking frustrating.
So to wrap up, James, you said that that MLB 2K10 is also on the Wii?
Yes, there is a Wii version. It's on everything, I believe.
Okay. I was just curious, why did you consider the Wii version? I assume there are some things in the Wii version that you're not going to get on Xbox.
I literally got the Xbox version because it has all that integration with the online stuff.
Because it has achievements?
No, I'm not an achievement whore. Like I said, I bought it because it was basically $30 off right now. Right now, because of the gamer days at GameStop, it's cheaper to buy it new than it is to buy it used by a notable margin.
Nice.
So you buy it and sell it back to them.
Thank you. Oh, by the way, I got something to sell you.
I've heard of people doing that from one store to another, but not at the same store.
I'm curious what they'd give you for the game right now.
Now, Greg, I'm actually really curious. Are you able, if you wanted to, could you buy PAL versions of baseball games in the UK?
Actually, a lot of them don't come out here. It's, of all the American sports, baseball seems to be the patchiest. For instance, Sluggers for Wii did not come out. I think the GameCube one did, but the Wii one didn't. And then The Show doesn't come out here. But yeah. PS3, you could import that if you really wanted it.
Yeah. Right.
All right, let's move on to video games, and John,
yeah,
we had a rare and glorious chance to actually play a game together this past week.
I'm sorry.
I'm so glad we did.
I'm not sure who I'm sorry for, but I'm definitely sorry.
It was fun. It was fun, yeah, definitely. Johnny and I hopped online to play a little bit of Modern Warfare 2. We've been meaning to, we've been talking about this on the podcast for months, trying to get on and do the co-op mode. And it was interesting. I mean, it's not quite... See, I always thought that the co-op mode was kind of like a story unto itself.
I thought that a little bit, too. It's more like not mini-games, but like mini-scenarios, like little mini-levels.
Yeah. Like, it reminded me kind of like from like Gears of War 2, it reminded me of like Horde mode.
There were a couple missions that were similar. Yeah, but it's really... actually just a lot of variety. I mean, some missions are you're playing certain segments of levels from the solo campaign, and some you're just kind of like taking an area from, you know, from a level from the solo campaign, but you're doing something completely different in it for co-op. And then in some cases you're playing, like we played that bridge level. It's like you're on, I don't know, basically the San Francisco Bridge or something like that, and it's basically falling apart as you walk across it and kill dudes. And that's not in the game otherwise at all.
Yeah.
And that level was amazing, I thought. It was fantastic.
Well, that's a cool thing that I like is the fact that they have so much to work with. I mean, just for dreaming up sort of co-op stuff like that is there's so many cool elements that they've done. Like the one I liked actually, it was near the end. We didn't get to play through it, but the one where I got to be up in the plane shooting down, shooting the cannon, and you were running along on the ground trying to get to a certain area. And so, you know, I'm sitting there from up top watching you run across your little blip on the map, and I see all of the enemies running, and, you know, it's all in night vision. And so, you know, it was just really cool. Like, out of nowhere, you're like, oh my God, okay, I'm in a plane, and I'm shooting down on all these people, and it looks just like you see in those, you know, when you see the film from the actual planes that are shooting people in like Iraq or whatever. It looks exactly like that. And so it was really cool. I've never actually seen that done in a game before, but to actually have that kind of be a cooperative experience was really, really neat. I really, really enjoyed it.
Well, this just a little bit of a tangent here, but I actually think that's one of the most emotionally involving moments in either of those games is when you're up in that plane, because you suddenly realize how detached it is from shooting someone.
Yeah.
I mean, you're kind of seeing like a blip that's being electronically generated based on a heat signature, and you put a cursor over it. It is literally like playing a video game.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in this case, you obviously are playing a video game, but when you say that's exactly what it looks like when they actually do it, it's like, wow.
Yeah.
This is basically Toys with Robin Williams and LL Cool J. Yeah. Like, they're...
Oh, boy.
No, yeah. I'm exaggerating there. But, yeah, I really like the levels where you're doing asymmetric co-op. There was another one that's similar where you have one person who's, like, sitting in a helicopter with a giant chain gun, mm-hmm. and the other person is running along on the ground, and you basically coordinate, hey, I see this guy up there, I can't get to him, can you shoot him down for me? That kind of thing. It's really cool stuff, and the only downside was that our voice chat got messed up after a few minutes, and so it was almost like playing a Wii game online. We're trying to cooperate, but I'm kind of guessing at what you want to do next, or what, yeah. you know. Do we want to replay this? I don't know. I don't know what John wants to do. I guess we'll
something weird happened.
It.
I'm not too sure what happened there, but like my voice chat just completely dropped.
I just assumed like there's some kind of listening station somewhere that Microsoft runs that heard John say whatever bullshit he was saying. Cut him off.
Incredibly eloquent, you mean? Of course.
Really? You're going to assert that what John says on Xbox Live is worse than what most people?
Well, you know,
are saying.
That makes yes. sense though, because sometimes I swear I'm being monitored.
I guarantee John and I are two of the more civilized people ever playing on. Xbox Live.
Yeah, exactly. Ever.
Maybe that was it. Too mature. How yeah. old is this guy? 50? Get him out.
Yeah, what? No one's dropped the N-word. Disconnect him. Get him out of here.
That's yeah. That's the password to keep playing.
Yeah, yep.
So, I really like that, and it did make me think, you know, it's not a Wii game, but... You know how they brought the first Modern Warfare to Wii last Christmas season? Mm-hmm. And maybe they'll do it again with the second one. I just wonder if they're going to keep in all the co-op stuff. And, you know, you would have to have voice chat to do it, really. It's just, it's very difficult to play this stuff without being able to communicate well. And, you know, I just thought, well, what about Black Ops? I mean, that is, Call of Duty Black Ops is coming this holiday season to the Wii.
Yeah.
And we don't really know much about the Wii version yet.
It'll be coming out day and date with the other versions, too.
I'm pretty sure Black Ops is going to have some co-op stuff. And, you know, they've been pretty good about doing all the online multiplayer and everything for Wii. And I just wonder if they're going to figure out a way to keep that in. Is it going to do Wii Speak? Is it going to do this headbanger?
Yeah. No, yeah. I hope it has headbanger thing. Support. That'd be really cool.
So you can get to buy a new piece of plastic.
Yes. And I'm pretty sure that Conduit 2 has online co-op. Mm-hmm. So, or some kind of co-op mode that's online. Mm. You know, that does support voice chat, obviously. But I wonder, you know, I don't think the design of it is going to be as good as Modern Warfare 2. But... It will be nice, because I was just thinking, like, I can't think of really any online co-op game on Wii other than, like, Monster Hunter. Well, certainly in terms of first-person shooters, I can't think of anything.
No.
So maybe that era is finally upon us for Hopefully. That to happen.
I hope so.
It's a really cool experience, actually. I mean, my favorite part was crawling through the snow and using our sniper rifles to pick off the guys, you know, before they saw us. That was awesome.
Yeah,
one of my favorite levels from the campaign, and being able to do it with another person and trying to communicate with each other and plan out, okay, I'll take this side, or hey, I see this guy, I'll take him. Fantastic.
Yeah, that's definitely, I mean, I think probably my favorite type of gameplay is kind of cooperative goals, right? Where you have to communicate and kind of think on the fly and coordinate stuff with each other. It's just really, really fun. Now, the other game I've been playing, I mentioned last week that I had a good deal on Final Fantasy 13. I think this was actually part of it was kind of fortunate because Best Buy had the $20 off coupon. And I think that actually happened to coincide with a price drop for Final Fantasy 13. I think it was technically on sale, but I think it was actually turned out to be a price drop down to $40. So long story short, wow. I got Final Fantasy 13 for $20.
And you recently finished Chrono Trigger, right?
Of course. You know, of course, because I really had a dearth of RPGs. So, you know, yeah, you know, I could not resist. And that's the thing. I'm really not a huge Final Fantasy fan, at least the newer versions. I think the last Final Fantasy game I actually bought was Final Fantasy X-2.
I haven't played that one.
I mean, it's interesting because, you know, obviously the graphics are great. Not as impressive as I thought they would be, really, because, you know, it kind of came out around the same time as God of War 3 and Uncharted 2 kind of already beat it to the graphical punch, I think. But, you know, the hype machine kind of made it like, oh my God, this will be the best looking game you will ever see in your entire life.
Well, it's a Square Enix game.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty much.
And the gameplay, I mean, it is, like Johnny said last week, I mean, it is a straight ahead. You are walking down a corridor fighting enemies.
It is literally linear.
Literally. I mean, you know, and in terms of an RPG, that's probably not what most people look for. But I actually kind of liked it because it really, you could tell they really made the story, the actual telling of the story, they put that above everything else because, I mean, you are force-fed the story. But the one thing that I did like, which is kind of, I think something sort of new for most RPGs, is that they really, they keep you abreast of the story. Like with Final Fantasy 13, on the load screens, it actually scrolls up like kind of like the story so far. Like in Dragon Quest IX, they have, you can click Y and it tells you the story so far. So you know exactly what's been going on. Even if you've put the game down for a week, you can come back to it, press Y and you're like, right. Oh, okay, great. Well, that's, you know, it gives you kind of a tailor-made summary of the last thing that you did.
Yeah, it's Vesperia has the same thing in the newspaper system.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually kind of, it's written like a newspaper. So like it hints at what your next objective is. Like, it's suspected that these terrorists are headed towards blank. Well, you would be the terrorist in question, so blank is where you're supposed to be going, so.
All right, well, I hope you'll be able to keep playing it, John. There's a lot more in store for you with Final Fantasy 13. That game, it opens up in terms of the systems pretty soon for you, and then eventually, mm-hmm. much later, it actually opens up in terms of the world as well, so. Layer upon layer, you'll peel back as you get farther into the game.
Yeah, I was actually, like I said, I'm not really a huge Final Fantasy fan, and I was actually surprised at how much it sucked me in. Like, it really kept me engaged.
I'm glad to hear it. I'm always glad when I recommend a game to someone and they say, oh yeah, I really liked it. Oh, you know, wipe the sweat off my brow.
You're the man, Johnny. You're the man.
So I'm going to bring it home with a WiiWare game to start off, Bit Trip Runner. And I know Greg talked about this game, really liked it. And I've had it for a few weeks and just had kind of picked it up a few times, do a few levels here, a few levels there. Finally, basically played the last half of the game over the past weekend and just got really into it. And you kind of have to. I mean, that game, Bit Trip Runner, it feels more like a nervous system response than a game.
I mean, that's probably, I enjoyed it quite a lot, but the little bit sort of tempered my enjoyment a little bit is it feels a bit too mechanical at times, I thought.
I can see that, but it's such a challenge to hone your mind to actually be able to do that mechanic that when you do it successfully, it feels incredible. When you get to the end of that level that you've tried, I mean, there's some of these levels I played 50 times in a row. I sat there and did the exact same thing, sequence of moves, 50 times until I got it right. And when I did, it was an amazing feeling.
If you're able to pass certain sections the first time on the fly, I mean, it is a rush. I mean, it's that intense. So it's just an incredible thing for a sort of listless, jaded person like myself to say.
It is. I'm not sure if Runner requires patience to play. It definitely requires persistence. Because it is incredibly unlikely that you will finish very many of these levels on your first time through. You're going to fail, and in a lot of cases, you will fail at exactly the same point over and over and over. And the first few times, you might not realize why you failed it. And then you kind of start to figure out, I need to jump just a hair earlier. Yeah. And then you try it again, and maybe you were in the zone and you weren't paying attention and that one spot crept up on you and you weren't thinking about it and so you messed up again, now you have to do it again. It's just, the nice thing about it is that even though it is kind of repetitive in that way and that you end up playing the same parts over and over until you get them exactly right, the game doesn't really punish you very much for failing. I mean, it sends you back to the beginning of the level, but there's no game over, there's no do-do-do-do.
No, it's instant.
It's instantly go back to the beginning of the level, and the cool thing is the music doesn't even stop.
No.
So basically the backbeat just keeps going on, and the backbeat never ever stops, and the level, it pauses at the beginning, and it waits for it to sync back up with the beat, and then you just go. You don't even have to push a button to replay, it just go. And because of that, it makes it very hard to get up and walk away from it when you can't beat a level. It's like, I have to, well, you know, it didn't even give me time to quit. I have to try again now. Okay, I failed. Oh, I have to try again now. It's amazing.
It reminds me of something that would honestly be on the Atari 2600.
Yes. But it's much better than any 2600 game I've ever played.
And I mean, with the pitfall-y bits, I mean, they're literally trying to make you think it is on the...
It basically is Pitfall, but you automatically run.
Yep.
And it's really fast, and it has great music and graphics. Bit Trip Runner is, I mean, it's a very simple game, but that does not mean it's easy by any stretch. No. And I love it. And I can definitely see how some people would not like it.
You know, it's divisive. It really is. I mean, there's quite a number of really high reviews online, and some people just hate it.
Yeah. It's not a game for everybody, but it is incredibly well made. And I think there's so much really, really wonderful thought and polish that's gone into it. I cannot wait to see what the next BitTrip game is going to be. This, to me, Runner is on a different echelon than the first three games.
It's priced differently, isn't it?
It is. It's $2 more, and it's worth the $2 more. It is. There's a lot more gameplay in this one than the others.
Yeah. I just really like games like that that just take that boil a game concept down to its most basic elements.
It's great stuff. I do want to say, if you haven't given it a shot, I think that if you like Rhythm Heaven, you're going to like BitTrip Runner. Greg, you've played both. You tell me.
Yeah, I've played both. Yeah, both Rhythm Heaven games and BitTrip Runner. Yeah, I mean, as I discussed this the first time I brought it up, there are similarities, definitely. But obviously, it is more uncompromising than the Rhythm Heaven game, because you don't, if for instance, you just happen to pluck one little hair off the potato or whatever incorrectly in Rhythm Heaven, it doesn't restart the song. But then again, with Rhythm Heaven, the one thing I would say is that it isn't like transparent. You never fail out, so you could just keep playing the song and actually be failing, and you wouldn't necessarily know. Whereas, of course, with this, there's never any ambiguity.
If you mess up, you're going back to the start right away.
But there's none of this. Oh God, I'm trying to remember what the name of my Rhythm Heaven nightmare is.
Lockstep.
Yes, there's no lockstep in this game, so it's instantly easier.
It definitely has some brutal levels. I mean, evil.
Yeah, and as I discussed, the longest levels, because there's just some that are quite a lot longer than the others.
Right. There's maybe two levels in the game that I think are really too long.
Especially towards the end. Towards the end of each world, there tends to be a quite a long one relative to the ones that came before it. But the ones I think it's something, like 3-9 or something like that. It's just sort of, wow.
Yeah, there's one called the Gauntlet that I'm pretty sure I played for about 2 hours. This level, if you played it straight through, it's probably 90 seconds long, and I played that level for 2 hours to give you an idea of what this game is all about. Yeah, you will play it perfectly, or you will not get through it. That's the way the game is. But I really love it, and it hones your reaction times and your reflexes to a razor sharp edge. And just to prove it to myself, I beat the game, and then I went back to the first world and I played some of the levels that I hadn't gotten all the gold bricks on the first time, and they were piss easy. I mean, and I thought they were hard the first time through. I went back to them after beating the game. It's like, man, this stuff, I could just about close my eyes and play it with the music.
Yeah, it's a very radical ramp up, and you just once you kind of get used to seeing certain patterns, certain motifs that repeat, it gets a lot easier to kind of anticipate what you need to do and then do it. And then the problem with that is in the later levels, those patterns are quite dense. Whereas if you go back to the earlier levels, the relative sparseness of them all of a sudden makes them seem very easy.
Right. Yeah, I feel like I'm ready for Top Gun School. So
you're not ready for Top Gun NES, though. No one's ready for
you
that.
You feel the need?
No one is. So the other big game that I've been playing this week is StarCraft II, and I'm early in it. I haven't even touched the multiplayer. I'm just doing campaign stuff right now, and that was the main reason I bought it, was for the campaign, because I suck at multiplayer. I hope the tutorials and all the challenge modes and everything can sort of teach me to play better, because I'd like to be okay at it. But the main reason is I wanted to get in the campaign. I like the campaign from the first StarCraft. I kind of like the campaign in Warcraft 3. So, I was definitely interested in what they're bringing with it. And I have to say that the campaign in StarCraft 2 is much better than I expected or even hoped for. And I read this in a preview somewhere and then forgot about it. But they integrate all, I knew that there was this kind of point-and-click adventure interface between levels, because you're on the ship and you can go from one room to the next and you can click on things to look at them or talk to people. And I knew that was there, and I was kind of, oh, that's kind of a cool way to do it. But there's also all this RPG stuff that lets you sort of accumulate money from finishing missions. And then between missions, you can spend it on upgrades for the different units that you have, and those upgrades are permanent. They last through the rest of the campaign. They don't apply to multiplayer, obviously, because in multiplayer you want everybody to be on an even basis. But in the campaign itself, you can get all this crazy stuff. I mean, I upgraded my Terran bunkers so that they hold 6 units each instead of 4, and they have like automatic turrets on top, so they double the firepower if I have them full of people, and they can defend the base even if I don't even have any soldiers inside of them. So there's all this really cool stuff that you can kind of tweak and customize. There's like a whole research thing where you have to choose between 2 different upgrades as you get to different levels. So you could feasibly even play through the whole campaign twice just to try all the different upgrades that you had to turn down the first time. It's really good stuff. The strategy gameplay is great, of course. The presentation's really nice. I mean, the graphics are great. I wish I could crank up some of the detail on my computer, but it's not really a gaming rig exactly. This is the first PC game I've bought for $60, for full price, to put it that way. Probably the first full price PC game I've bought since Warcraft 3.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I bought the orange box, but I bought it on like half price special, so. I don't do PC games very much, but I'm very glad that I'm playing StarCraft 2. I like it a whole lot, and very excited to finish the campaign, and hopefully we'll have built up enough confidence that I can try the multiplayer and not be totally creamed.
Yeah, a friend of mine at work actually picked it up, and he gave me one of the free passes that you get with it, so.
Free pass? I didn't know there was such a thing.
Yep.
What is that? Like a demo?
Guest pass, invite a friend to play StarCraft 2 with his free guest pass key. Yeah, it lasts for 7 hours of game time or 14 days from activation, whichever comes first.
Cool. Well, give it a shot, man. I think you'll like it a lot.
Yep.
And maybe we could play together.
Is this the start of a trend?
John, we should just have like a weekly play date night.
Oh, dear.
Amy, I have a date with Johnny tonight. You never buy me flowers anymore.
Let's just quit the podcast and we'll play games on Thursday nights instead of doing the show.
Done.
Yeah, that's the thing for John. They are mutually exclusive.
All right. Before we finish up, I did want to make a very quick mention that as John and I were playing Modern Warfare 2 together, I saw on my Xbox friends list that Jared Rosenberg, a wonderful guy who writes for our website, was online, and he was playing Geometry Wars 2, and I was like, oh, I haven't seen anybody playing that in a long time. And then John went over to play it. I was like, I'm going to boot this up. I haven't touched Geometry Wars 2 in like a year. I booted it up. Jared has obliterated my high scores on several of the modes, including my beloved pacifism, where I used to get like comments from friends who said, like, what deal with the devil did you make to get that pacifism high score?
Well, yeah, I mean, like on my high score, it's like it goes, you know, 1.5 mil, 2 mil, 3 mil, 4 mil, then you're at 13 million.
John's high scores go down, by the way, in case anybody's noticed.
Yeah, I'm awful at that
game.
So,
on pacifism, I don't remember who was, I think it was Justin Davis. I don't remember, he used to write for Game Daily. I don't know if he still does. I think he was number 2 under me on pacifism. He had like 60 million and I had 101 million. And then that day when I logged in, Jared had 160 million and I'm like, "Oh snap." And so I played for a while, tried to set a new score, wasn't able to. And then I went back a couple days later to play some more of it, and Jared had raised his high score up to 300 million. So, I don't know if I have any hope of ever getting up to that level of play, but damn it, he has definitely motivated me to actually pick up that game and spend some time on it. And
dude, there's just something about that game, man. I started playing it, I just popped it in just for the hell of it, you know. I had like 5 minutes to kill and I was like, this is really good, I'm gonna start playing this again.
I know, I felt the same way. I was like, man, why did I stop playing Geometry Wars 2?
Yeah.
Oh, wait, because I was skipping meals. That's why. It is an incredible game, and I'm really surprised. Well, I guess it was published by Microsoft. Maybe that's why it hasn't come out on any of the other platforms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I love the Wii game, Galaxies. I know Greg's a big fan. I really wish they'd do another one of those. But where's my Geometry Wars 3? It's been 2 years now, and that is not a huge production. It's a small game, but I think about how much time I've spent on that game, and I think, God, I paid $10 for it.
Yeah.
Unbelievable value. There's an incredible amount of thoughtful design and just brilliant gameplay and a lot of totally different modes, you know, modes that feel completely different from each other. And that's in a $10 game package.
Mm-hmm.
Just incredible.
And it's testament to the effectiveness of online high score tables and friend lists. You know, it's just,
absolutely.
It's, yeah, you get to people to reconnect with games.
Right. Yep. So you're saying games like Endless Ocean could be improved if they had a high score friends list.
No.
It's like
no,
your
it
friend
depends.
Found three vases. Get your ass back in here.
Geometry Wars is arcadey as it gets.
Yeah.
It would be something if it was just like, oh, your friend's playing that game. You know, even if you didn't own the game, it might make you think about it more. You know, I mean, there's a pretty big use for this sort of thing that Nintendo has yet to grasp.
Yeah.
They don't grasp an online functionality? Shocking.
There are a few Wii games with online scoreboards, but other than, I think, maybe Mario Kart, they're not really ranked by people who you're actually friends with, and
yeah, Mario
that
Kart's
just
good
totally
about that.
Defeats the purpose. Mario Kart has great online features and still hasn't really been replicated in over two years.
And then Sin Punishment has them, right, Greg?
Yeah, it's got the score tables, but I don't think it's got any kind of friends thing going on.
It's just scores you'll never beat. Listed one after another. And you just go, holy shit, what happened?
I don't really care to see the scores of the best players in the world. It's so far beyond the horizon for me.
It's a bit abstract, really. That's
right.
Sort of more, you know, rooted kind of context of a friends list one. It's good.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I just wanted to give some kudos to Jared Rosenberg. You are a god of Geometry Wars 2, as far as I'm concerned. And now we're going to take a break. When we come back, listener mail. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. Alrighty, this week on NintendoWorldReport.com, we've got a new feature. It's the Retro Revival number 2 for Yoshi's Story. Zach takes a look at the surprisingly controversial follow-up to Yoshi's Island, the N64 platformer Yoshi's Story. Find out what he loves and hates about this cutesy little title that could very well be the precursor to Kirby's epic yarn. We also have a blog from Neil. It's the unboxing of Telloroboxer, the Virtual Boy game. Yes, Telloroboxer. He unboxed the shit out of Telloroboxer. Flaunts as well, showing off a sealed copy. I haven't looked at this, John. Did he unseal it?
Yep. Good. It was actually a 15-year-old game that was completely sealed.
Douglas Gregory of Frozen North Productions provides us a developer diary for their upcoming game, Flip's Twisted World, in which he describes the concept and the gameplay behind the game, and is a, quote, fascinating look at game design from every aspect of the game creator. Also, Zach writes us a rage-filled blog in which he titles Out of Options when he describes how he's mad at the fact that there aren't many options of game stores in his area. Which is Alaska.
Yeah.
Which should be surprising.
Zach should move to America, and then you won't have this problem.
Move to America, Zach.
You have a Hawaiian president. You can't really have that line about the freak states anymore.
I do want to say, actually, Flip's Twisted World, I didn't know anything about that game, and I read the blog. I was like, oh, this is really cool. If they pull that off, that is a great idea for a game. It's basically like an M.C. Escher puzzle that you play, and you just flip the world in 90 degrees by moving the Wii Remote around. It's a platformer. Sounds awesome.
In reviews, Pedro takes a look at Tournament of Legends. He gives us his take on High Voltage's new Wii Fighter and whether or not it stands up to other fighting games out there on the market.
Well, other fighting games on the Wii, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
We also have a blog from Carly about the aforementioned Nintendo event in London, where she gives her impressions of the 3DS title Hollywood 61, which is, I think, is Ubisoft. It's weird. And Wii titles like Kirby's Epic Yarn, Donkey Kong Country Returns, and more.
It's like E3 all over again,
except much smaller and with free drinks
and Englisher.
Much more proper. Okay, we have a review from Zach, Transformers Cybertron Adventures for Wii. Zach reviews this new on-rail shooter, an on-rail shooter on the Wii. It's so unexpected. And tells us whether or not the dynamic nature of the Transformer universe can be crammed into the on-rails formula.
Apparently not.
Maybe you should get Sin and Punishment instead.
All right, and we also have plenty of new screenshots thoughts for Street Fighter 4 3D Edition.
With crotch looking and crotch punching.
As well as a ton of new video from Metroid Other M. We have a whole bunch of gameplay clips. Yep, so be sure to check those out.
See if you can spot the third nipple. All right, we are back for the listener mail. All the people you're about to hear from wrote into rfn at nintendoworldreport.com. And Greg's first.
RW writes, for anyone who's using Netflix on their Wii and has a 16:9 TV, have you noticed that all Superscope movies will automatically stretch to fill your 16:9 TV? In other words, even if the film's original aspect ratio is wider than 16:9, as in Superscope's 2.35:1, it will still be presented in 16:9. And yet the only way to correct it is to change the Wii settings to think you're using a 4:3 TV in the menu section. That's totally absurd, and the software should be fixed so that this extra step isn't necessary. Just to be clear, this only affects movies that have wider ratios than 16:9. Do you guys know about this? Does this also happen with 360 and PS3?
All right, can I start?
Yeah.
Film nerd!
Yeah, but...
No, I mean, you'd notice, trust me, if you had something like, you know, all the Star Wars movies, so like 2.35:1.
Yeah, I know,
If you just hacked off the bits at the side, which is essentially what you're doing in this case that he's talking about, a lot of shots would look pretty strange, because they are framed specifically for that aspect ratio.
Right.
But the funny thing is, a lot of these, if you buy them on DVD, aren't 16:9 already, so it's kind of... strange.
Yeah, they do pan and scan stuff, anamorphic. I don't understand all of that. As you guys know, I hate widescreen.
Yeah, DVDs are almost exclusively in their original aspect ratios. You know, for a long time now. I don't know about the really early bullshitty ones, like from the late 90s, but since then, they're very good about presenting the film as they were originally intended, rather than VHS, which, yeah, was obviously pre-widescreen, brutal pan scan crap.
I enjoy the VHS pan scan. I don't know what you're talking about.
It's the only way to watch Rambo 3.
It's like it's been redirected, right?
But, you know, it's like you're watching multiple TVs and just turning in an office
chair.
Well,
it's like when you have like a dinner scene, for instance, and they frame it so it's, you know, two people at opposite ends of the table, opposite ends of the wide shot.
Ping-ponging back and forth.
So they just have to have this like... over to
the really, really bad ones where they just leave it right in the middle of it and you just get the centerpiece of the table.
You just get bugger all, yeah. And sometimes they even have to just completely fudge the proportions. Like when they used to show Star Wars on TV, you'd get to the end of the movie where they're getting the medals in episode 4. Mm-hmm. And of course they're all lined up in a wide shot, so they just kind of squashed it up to fit
everyone
in.
Man,
they
got tall.
It's like
thin.
They got thin. I mean, what happened? it's an issue. It's kind of strange. There's no reason why you couldn't just have it presented in 2.35. And of course we don't have Netflix here, so I have no direct experience.
I heard they just added it to Canada.
Yes, they did. So Netflix didn't exist in Canada before, I believe, and now it's just streaming only, though.
Well, that's good.
They also just got running water, also.
Yeah.
Before, they used to just survive on mountain streams. I can vouch for this.
John can vouch for how hard it would be to get a DVD to Yellowknife. I mean, you'd have to hire Eskimos.
Damn near
to take
impossible.
It there.
It's a barter economy, so you know you got.
Right. You'd have to trade beaver pelts for your Netflix subscription. They don't have the processing to handle all those beaver pelts.
Pelts, boys, pelts. It's all about pelts.
So, in all seriousness, I don't know if this is a bug or just bad content delivery. Maybe it's a problem on Netflix. I know that if you ever watch a Netflix instant movie that's provided by Stars, they tend to be kind of bad versions. Like they're low video quality and they're not in the right aspect ratios. So it might also depend on just specifically which provider, you know, which distribution network they're getting it from. But in terms of could this be fixed, unfortunately, probably not, because Netflix on Wii depends on a disc. And I don't think they're going to send out a new disc just with a better version of the software, partially for the expense of it, but also because, you know, they could confuse the users or whatever. So I've heard that the agreement between Netflix and Microsoft for a no-disc version of the feature has some kind of expiration date. I don't know what that expiration date is, but maybe when that expires, Netflix will issue a free download, digital-only version, no-disc version for PS3 and Wii, and they'll be able to fix a few things in those versions and continually update it after that.
It's definitely coming to PS3 discless. I've heard that already.
Yeah, I've heard of it, but I don't know what the timeline is for that. And, you know, there's no reason they can't do it for Wii as well.
Well, I mean, it depends on how big the Netflix apps has to be, I guess.
It's pretty small, I think. I think it's reasonably within WiiWare size. Or it could be made to be smaller. So I think it's reasonable that they could do that. You know, we'll see. But for now, as long as it's on a disc, you're not getting a new version of it, unfortunately. So any problems that you have with the way Netflix works on your system, it's going to have to stay that way. It has actually, they have upgraded it on the Xbox, because the first year you couldn't even add new things to your queue. And yes. Then after the first year, they upgraded it, added a lot of new features. So I think it's within the realm of possibility that they'll do that on the other systems as well, once they have the ability to do it. So that's it. Sorry to hear of your aspect ratio troubles. Maybe it'll get fixed one day. James has the next letter.
Yes. Michael writes, and then this is a note, during the handheld wars discussion of episode 202, it struck me that the impact of the iTouch and iPhone in the handheld gaming market was never brought up. Sure, the PSP or rumored PSP2 will probably not significantly change Nintendo 3DS marketing strategy, but Apple iTouch and iPhone gaming apps and Nintendo target similar audience, the casual gamer. In my experience with the casual gamer, they are more attracted to these 99-cent games than the DS, and even use the apps as their primary method of consuming games. I believe 3D capability was added in recognition of the competition with Apple. However, I think that Apple is successfully pushing Nintendo out of the casual gaming market in handhelds. What are the crew's thoughts about this issue? Is Apple a big competitor? Should Nintendo shift their focus from the casual market?
John, I look to you as the expert here because you have an iPhone, right?
Well, the thing is, I mean, I know a lot of people that have iPhones, and I don't see people playing, and I mean, maybe this just kind of speaks to the iPhone audience. I don't know how much overlap there is with, like, you know, kind of the quote-unquote hardcore gamer audience and the iPhone audience, which is much larger. But from the people that I know that own iPhones, you know, people that are in IT, people that are kind of tech savvy or whatever, a lot of them don't use their iPhone to play gamer games. You know, they'll play stuff like Scrabble or Words with Friends and stuff like that. I mean, I know Insano Lord from our forums, he's an App Store fiend. And I think Andy Gergen is as well from our site. They buy a whole lot of iPhone apps, but it just still seems to me like the realm of kind of board games and stuff like that. I mean, I don't think you'll ever have stuff like Pokemon or Mario or franchises like that on the iPhone.
Well, and I think another issue with the iPhone, especially in its market structure, is that the vast majority of stuff on it, and John, I think you can back me up here, is shit.
Absolutely.
It could be very easy to get buried in a sea of crap.
Yeah,
in the iPhone marketplace.
And I mean, really, I've just actually, you know, the one game I just picked up out of curiosity, Space Harrier 2 is out on iPhone, and you know, I'm a big Space Harrier fan from way back. So I was like, what the heck? You know, it was like $1, so I picked it up.
And this is the Mega Drive game, right? The Genesis game originally.
The Genesis version, I think.
Yeah.
But you know, the problem with it, I've always had a big problem with only touchscreen controls, because for any kind of arcade style game, it's really goofy. Like something like Street Fighter 4, I would never play that on iPhone.
Oh, or Resident Evil for the iPhone.
Yeah, all that stuff. It's just, you know, I mean, you're really shoehorning it into the iPhone's, you know, controls.
And that's a huge advantage the 3DS has, is that it has a joystick and a D-pad and face buttons and shoulder buttons, and it has a touchscreen.
Yes.
And gyroscopes over all that. So it can still do a lot of the stuff that iPhone does, but it also has traditional game controls, and so you're going to get more and better traditional games on 3DS.
Well, to me, it's like you know, why do you think you know, like the best platforming games came out on consoles as opposed to PC? Well, it's because console games suck with a keyboard and mouse. just like most arcade-style games or games that require very precise controls, suck on the iPhone because touchscreen controls are crap. If you don't, you know, if you're doing it with your finger, it's crap.
So are you perhaps insinuating that in certain aspects, touchscreen controls could work better on the DS because of the implementation of a stylus instead of using your fingers to control it?
Yes, I am.
So the prime example here of touchscreen control being Phantom Hourglass and...
Spirit Tracks.
Yes. So that those games are thoroughly touch control only, but mm-hmm. but are you insinuating that a game like that would be more difficult on the iPhone or iTouch?
I don't know. I think it's limited because people will ultimately be controlling it with their fingers, so you have to make all the icons extra big. Mm-hmm. There's just stuff like that. I mean, you only have so much real estate on there on that screen.
Even if Zelda wasn't made by Nintendo, it wouldn't come out on iPhone because that game costs a lot of money to make.
Oh, well, yeah, I understand that. But
you could make a $30 iPhone game, but no one would buy it until it drops down to $2, and at that point, your company's going bankrupt.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, to me, the value of 3D is that it's not that because the physical media is more expensive, it's because it is a dedicated gaming device, and that's why people buy it. If you're a developer or a publisher releasing games on 3DS, you know that people want games. That's the reason they bought it. Mm-hmm. And so they're more willing to spend money and spend their time on these games, whereas people with the iPhone, gaming's not the primary purpose of that device. And people might download games, but they're not going to spend very much money on it because that's not why they own it.
Yeah, or much time either. It really is. If you want to talk about quick hit gaming, that's the iPhone.
Yeah, I think they're largely separate markets.
Yeah,
I mean, and yeah. I understand there's some crowding of, you know, people's time or people's money of it. You know, ultimately you might have to make decisions. Do I want to buy 10 iPhone games or one 3DS game? You know, that's a decision people can make. I don't think they're eating into each other that much.
Well, I think it's well established there that there is quite, you know, separate elements to the two markets here. And I suppose that goes to what Michael's raising in the question is that, you know, do Nintendo, rather than, you know, with the DS, they kind of made forays into areas that were more, you know, away from the games that can only be done really on a kind of dedicated gaming device.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of raising the possibility that they might kind of be a retrenchment sort of back towards specific, you know, traditional games because maybe the iPhone is going to eat into that new kind of market that they created. Maybe there's some merit in that, but I think there's still a separation between, you know, the kinds of things that Nintendo have done with, you know, a brain training or, you know, Nintendogs and what is available on the iPhone. I mean, even though those games, you know, they don't require the precision of, you know, a D-pad.
They require the imprecision of voice recognition.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, the way they're developed and all the kind of broad audience that they're appealing to, like for instance, like the popularity that brain training might have been able to reach with older users and stuff. I don't know. I mean, are they likely to have an iPhone? You know, maybe a DS is something that's a bit more straightforward and, you know, for a very specific use, mm-hmm. is more something that they can actually grapple with. With Nintendogs, you know, for children, you've got to think about it as well. It's sort of, I think a dedicated game device is sort of more for them.
It's more affordable for everybody. I mean,
yeah.
I read some kind of editorial. This guy was trying to do some business analysis, and from what I can tell, was completely unqualified for anything of the sort. But he was trying to say that the iPhone crowd doesn't want a 3DS because they're every year there's a new iPhone and they can get the latest and greatest technology. And I'm like, yeah, but that also completely voids his argument that the iPhone's only $200 and the 3DS will probably be $250.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, it's $200 every year. Plus you have to pay that, you know, that huge monthly bill. And mm-hmm. I know it does more than the 3DS, but I can buy a 3DS next spring, and I know that 5 years later it will still play all the brand new 3DS games that are released.
And you have to remember that there's a lot of people out there, they just want a phone. They don't give a crap about the iPhone. There's still a lot of people out there like that.
Even that, mm-hmm. even there, I mean, the people who don't buy into the Apple marketing machine, remember, it's magical, but do buy competitors. I mean, right now, the Android, even with the iPhone 4 came out, the Android sold better that month than Apple products did. So Android-based phones. So there is definite market fragmentation taking place in that particular sector now as well, which you can't directly port a game from iOS to Android or the other way around, mostly because of internal barriers Apple put into their development kit. Mm-hmm. So what you're going to wind up with is you could very well see in the future there are two or three markets based on what operating system phones are running that software is available based on those markets, and you have kind of weird, crazy fragmentation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the portable, dedicated gaming device market is going to be a lot more unified than the cell phone gaming market will be in a few years, for sure, if that's your point.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, it could be very difficult to be a casual game developer and be able to hit everybody you want to hit. I mean, essentially, you're going to have to redevelop the game because the iOS operating system is incredibly locked down in development standards and the code you have to use to develop with it.
Well, speaking of porting games, I think the one place where the iPhone and iPod Touch have decimated Nintendo is in downloadable games for portable devices. And Nintendo has made this kind of sad attempt to mimic the App Store with DSiWare. And
I don't see the problem with DSiWare. I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, it completely misses the point. It completely misses the point because it sits in this no man's land between real games that come out on physical media and cost full price, which is one thing, and the super cheap, super casual stuff that just floods the iPhone marketplace. And the reason the iPhone marketplace works is that there is so much of that.
Yeah.
And you can't half-ass it, which is what Nintendo's trying to do, this compromise thing. But what you get with DSiWare is basically the same shit that you get on iPhone, except a lot less of it.
Well, because they hold the reins, I mean, and they hold them tightly.
Right, they're throttling down the amount of content, but the content itself is basically ported from the iPhone, or it's at least similar stuff to the iPhone. So it's still not good. You know, I mean, it's in general, the DSiWare content is not really that great. It's still like ultra casual stuff, except it costs twice as much on DSi, and you get 1% as much of it. So you don't get the democratic process of like the really good stuff rising to the top and all the amazing ideas that you'd never see before. That doesn't really happen on DSiWare because it's too controlled. So it's not controlled enough, and yet it's too controlled. It ends up really not satisfying anybody.
Are you saying that your itches aren't scratched by Puffin's Let's Race, and then Ubisoft both pets cats and pets hamsters in back-to-back weeks? I mean, I don't know what else you could need.
No, the one thing I will say is I do think there's still room in the market, and I think it's still kind of wide open in this sense. I think the iPhone showed this, is that I still think that there's room for a super device where it could take like the best of the DS, combine that with a phone in some sort of form factor that actually works, and I think that could possibly make a huge dent in the market.
I think that's what PSP 2 will be.
But the form factor is the really tricky part, because you have to manage to make it small enough you can put it in your pocket while still having screens that are large enough to make the gaming experience compelling.
Exactly.
And squeeze in all the other functionality expected of a phone and a media player, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep.
And put a good interface on it. I mean, you have to get like 15 things right.
Yeah.
If you screw one up, you end up with the N-Gage.
I suppose the real question is to what extent, if people, you know, pick up, they have an iPhone because they just want an iPhone, and then they kind of incidentally get into picking stuff up off the App Store and playing games in that sort of most casual way. To what extent is that choking off demand for a DS because they're sated, they've had enough, that's their level of gaming, they've fulfilled?
See, those people wouldn't have spent $250 on a dedicated gaming device anyway, and
that's sort of what I'm thinking. I mean, the only thing I could come back to in terms of where there might be a rivalry is not so much in that sense, but perhaps if someone has a DS and an iPhone, that they might start to take the DS with them a bit less if they've got an iPhone. So, oh, well, you know, I could just have the one device with me, and that's got enough game for it. And then maybe they start to use their DS less, and then over time maybe they buy fewer games for it because they're not using it as much, and it's like a kind of subtle long-term kind of decline of use because there's a kind of rivalry for what devices you're going to take on the go and things like that. So I think there is... some overlap there. There is some rivalry there, but yeah, I don't see it as being particularly massive kind of overlap. And to be fair, to speak to sort of Michael's point, I mean the 3DS is to some extent sort of doubling down and going to the kind of more traditional games angle to begin with. I mean, you do have the slide pad there. The graphics are much improved. Mm-hmm. You know, they're the kinds of things that people who buy dedicated game systems want to see in their next dedicated game system, very, very much so. So, I mean, they are making, you know, explicit appeals to that audience, but, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, we're still going to see stuff like Nintendogs, clearly, because we've already seen that.
Because it's already there.
And Animal Crossing and all the other stuff, probably plenty of brain training and, you know, more America's Test Kitchen type stuff, and I don't think it's going to bomb. I still think it's going to do pretty well.
America's 3D Tech.
Oh, what a brave prediction, Greg.
this is what he's saying, basically, is just that, you know, well, the casual games are more attracted to the apps and, you know, therefore, you know, how much of a problem is that? And it's like, well, I don't think it's going to stop Nintendo from being very successful.
There's room for both because they're ultimately both doing different things.
Well, which device are you going to buy for your kids? You're not going to buy an iPhone for your kids.
Well, I mean, maybe you do if they nag you.
Oh, I mean, you might get them an iPod
Touch.
Maybe
you want to see an iPhone get flushed down the toilet.
Maybe there is some overlap and maybe there is some competition, but it's kind of, to me, it's kind of on the fringes of each one of their markets. And I think Nintendo's going in a completely different direction with the 3DS. I mean, it's pretty clear this is even more of a hardcore gaming machine than DS was in the beginning. And maybe over time, through software releases, they will make 3DS appeal to grandmothers all over again and moms and, you know.
Yeah, reach out as it goes, yeah.
Exactly. But from the start, it's pretty clear to me that they are marketing this towards tweens, teens and young adults.
And I mean, to be fair, I suppose there is some merit to the idea. Yeah, they've added 3D, and that is kind of like, yeah, this is your real, genuine value added. This is why you're going to pay more for these kinds of games, because it is unique, it is special, because it is a dedicated games device. You know, it's a lot easier in the minds of, you know, people who are not like consistently plugged into games all the time, so make a kind of more superficial but also kind of powerful argument that this is a different kind of device that is specialized.
And but how long will that last? I mean, it wouldn't shock me at all for iPhone 5 next summer to come out with a 3D screen with no glasses.
Mm-hmm.
That technology is out there and other people can use it too, and Nintendo has to build a foundation of, we're about the games, you buy this because you want the games that are on it, not just 3D, because 3D will ultimately be a commodity.
Yeah, it is going to lose its novelty in terms of a market-wide over time, but I mean, that I think that'll help in the early going, and then once you get bedded down, it just becomes easier and easier from there.
I mean, the 3D is nice because it's so clearly the most important feature. And, you know, we go back to the DS and at the launch of the DS, I wasn't sure what was the most important feature.
But yeah, neither were they.
It was just such a weird mishmash of things. With 3DS, they can really focus their message, and I think it's much more obvious how they're going to sell this thing to people. But, you know, at the end of the cycle, 5 years from now, when we're looking back and doing a retrospective feature on 3DS, I doubt that 3D will be such a big deal by then. We'll all have 3D TVs, and we'll have our 3D PSP2s and our 3D iPhones, and it's going to be what games came out. The joystick will probably be a bigger deal.
So we'll all be, God, I love the slide pad.
Tag mode, stuff like that.
If I ever get excited about tag mode, shoot me, please.
Online video chat.
I'm going to trick you into getting excited about tag mode and then shoot you.
It's going to be impossible.
I'll put that on my calendar right now. James, I got cupcakes. Cupcakes? Oh, wait a minute. I meant tag mode.
All right. John, you have the next letter.
All right. Let's see. Nathan writes, firstly, I love that each of you has a distinct style or affection in your gaming habits. James, for example, is the RPG guy. I should say crabby RPG guy. But it's his critical mind that makes him an excellent voice of reason.
Voice of reason?
This email is certainly suspect right off the bat. John is the guy whose life has become so busy that his habit is sometimes regulated to buying games without opening them. We've all been there.
No, we haven't. Or it would be funny.
Johnny is perhaps the biggest Metroid fan I've ever heard of, and Greg appears to be the most like me. He loves a good shooter, heavily uses his virtual console, and delights in the old-school challenge offered up in NES and SNES action platformers and side-scrollers. To that end, I turn to my favorite genre, the 2D side-scroller. Excluding the Mario series, could you each name one or two of your favorite side-scrollers and explain why you enjoy them so? The more obscure, the better. I'll be listening, waiting to hear about some good ideas for me to search out on eBay to try for myself.
Well, when you say side-scroller, he means platform or just side-scroller in
platform,
general?
Yeah. Yeah, could give
maybe,
sort of
maybe a running-gun thing like Contra, Mega Man.
Yeah.
Some kind of action-y, 2D action-y platformer.
But not
thing.
Like Chouniki.
I was gonna say.
Lords of Thunder.
Just a
Gradius,
random,
you know.
Random picked out of the air example by Greg.
No, not those side scrollers.
Well, no, I'm upset because I was going to basically interrupt John before he saw it and said, not Chouniki, John. No.
No, I think he means maybe games in which you can jump or use a bionic arm as a reasonable substitute.
Or perhaps you're a commando?
No. I don't know what you're talking about.
By the way, Nathan wrote a long email and had really some very, very kind things to say about the show, and we didn't have time to read it all, but I wanted to acknowledge it and thank him for this really cool question about our favorite obscure 2D side-scrollers.
Yes, I mean, a couple of ones that I played are the Japanese virtual consoles. They're pretty obscure. If you haven't got a Japanese Wii, I suppose the way you get them on eBay is maybe by picking up the Famicom, the Super Famicom cartridges, and maybe playing through an adapter if you've still got a working Super NES. But two Goemon games, the second and third games for the Super Famicom, in the Goemon series, are very good. I really like those. The second of which is purely side-scrolling platformer.
Ah.
Very Super Mario World-ish.
It's like the second N64 game, Goemon's Greatest Adventure, which did come out in America, but is now really hard to find.
Yeah, that's the thing. See, I mean, there were a few Goemon games that did come out, like the first one on the Super Famicom was Legend of Mystical Ninja, and then was it a couple of ones on N64 that came out in America?
Yep.
But there's loads of games in that series. Either go back to the Famicom, you know, NES era, that didn't come over, and there's three Super Famicom games that didn't come over. And I've played two of those, and they're both very good. Like I said, the second one is the most like a kind of Mario platformer. It has an overworld map that's kind of similar, but you do get the sort of wrinkle in that one is you get these sort of giant punch-out style mech boss fights, which also come back in the N64 one, right?
Yep.
And then in the third one, it's a bit more of a mix because you've actually got side-scrolling levels, but there's a kind of Zelda-like overworld that links them together, played from a three-quarter overhead view.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of interesting, you know, genre-blending kind of game. But they're really fun games, you know, typical of Konami Super Famicom games of the day, you know, really cool music, good graphics, very solid side-scrolling platform action.
Yeah, well, in terms of something that you can get in the U.S., I think in Europe as well, there's the Super Famicom game Doremi Panic. You know, it's Doki Doki Adventure, Mylan's Doki Doki Adventure. That's a very good, it's a kind of a sequel to Mylan's Secret Castle, but it plays very differently. It plays more like a Mario game. And it's very nice, good music, good graphics, pretty obscure, but it has actually been released as an import title on Virtual Console.
That's right, yeah.
Some things off the top of my head that aren't as easily available, but you could probably find on eBay, I would say a lot of these are going to be in Super Nintendo. Demon's Crest from Capcom, that's the really, really
jerk.
Great... Oh, did I steal it? Sorry,
yes.
James. Demon's Crest is kind of Mega Man-ish in that you gain abilities from beating bosses, and they, you know, you can use those, you gain different forms, you can turn into the Sky Goblin and the Fire Goblin or whatever, or Gargoyles, not Goblins. But that is a really wonderful game. It's pretty hard to find, but and it's difficult, but man, it's fantastic stuff. I'd also throw down ActRaiser 2, which is a game that people hate. People love to hate.
Because it ruined the series!
Well, it certainly did away with my favorite part of the first ActRaiser.
It's like it got rid of my favorite part of the game. I love
it. But it improved the other part that I didn't like as much in the first one. And ActRaiser 2 is a very good but incredibly difficult side-scrolling platform game. You have a sword, you have a shield, you have wings, you have all these magic abilities. The level design is so tough, but the graphics and the music are spectacular, and I do recommend that you check it out if you're not afraid of really brutally hard games. On the lighter side, Smart Ball is a really cool Super Nintendo platformer. You play as this blue blob of slime, and you squeeze through crevices in the walls, and you stretch out to climb up things. A lot of fun. And Claymates is a really cool action platformery game. It's, I think, made by the same people who did Clay Fighter, but Claymates is a lot better. And yeah, Clay Fighter is kind of, it's amusing but shitty, and Claymates is actually a really good 2D platformer for Super Nintendo that I don't think very many people know about, but definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of mentions for treasure games I can think of that are a bit more, you know, that are not like the crazy kind of action stuff of something like Gunstar Heroes or shooter stuff or whatever.
You're gonna steal mine, Greg. I know you are. I know you're gonna steal it.
Well, I was gonna mention Dynamite Heady.
Okay.
Our first retroactive game. That's a cool platformer by Treasure with all these different sort of head power-ups. that's got a little bit of a Little Big Planet vibe going on, because it's all supposed to be like a puppet show. Yeah. And it obviously doesn't come across so much with the level of detail of Genesis graphics and the limited color palette and everything. And the other one I was going to mention is Mischief Makers for the N64. Is a little bit different again. That's got it's quite a bizarre game. I went back to it recently because
shake.
I mean, the levels are kind of the scattershot nature of the levels are, so it kind of reminds me a little bit of the Bangaio Spirits for DS, because like they're really scattershot because they're kind of just like all levels you could have made with the level editor, but it's less sort of easily explained in Mischief Makers. It's kind of all over the place. I came back to it recently because I played it and I got to this level where it's basically like a bunch of track and field type mini games, and I couldn't fucking win them by button mashing or whatever. I was really struggling. I just put it down and I came back and I realized that actually, well, if you button mash the D-pad, you just go a lot faster than if you button mash the C buttons.
Nice.
Bizarre, but it is actually really quite a fun game. Other than some of its weirdness, with, I mean, you know, guess what? Awesome boss fights. What a surprise, right? That is generally what Treasure do.
Yeah, a lot of boss fights throwing stuff at you from the background. And
yeah.
So, Metal Warriors for the SNES.
Ooh, I've heard of this.
Yeah, it's a 2D side-scrolling mech game where you basically, you can get out of your mech, steal other mechs. It's an amusing game developed by LucasArts that wasn't a Star Wars or a point-and-click adventure game.
Hmm.
Metal Slug.
Oh, sure.
Anyone you want, because there are about 400,000 of them.
They're all the same.
Oh, totally. I mean, they're all fun, though. They are the most same-ish series in the history of same-ish series.
And so, naturally, you get the Wii collection, you can play.
Then you're done.
All
you're good. And you can probably get it for about $5. And then, obviously, as I've discussed on the show, because I'm an RPG guy, any litany of Mega Man games I've played, which would be all of them.
Sure.
That's not Mega Man ZX. Because, seriously, fuck Mega Man ZX.
I was trying to think of some on NES that I think are... I don't know if there's that many obscure ones that I think are actually good.
Yeah.
If there are, we don't know them, because there was so much stuff on the NES that it's very easy for it to get buried.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I think of maybe Clash of Demon Head, if you can find a copy of that. That's
I like stuff like
classic.
Karnov. I really enjoyed that.
I like Karnov, too. Karnov's a little broken, but...
Oh, yeah, Karnov is fantastically broken.
Yeah, it's sort of primitive, but also, like, weirdly deep and complicated.
I mean, there's, like, Ninja Gaiden on the NES.
Yeah.
Sure, the Ninja Gaiden stuff, it's not obscure, but it's really good. And, by the way, and this is a legitimate, I'm totally serious here, MC Kids. If you can find a copy of MC Kids, it's actually really, really, really fun. I highly recommend that.
If you want obscure...
And Fasanadu would be really cool if you can find a copy of that for NES.
Yeah, for TurboGrafx-16, a really good platformer for that is the Legendary Axe.
That is not on Virtual Console.
No. I'm surprised it was. I mean, it was one of the biggest games, especially... Actually, I think it was the big launch game for the TurboGrafx-16.
Rygar for the NES has some stuff like that, too.
Dude, I'm with you, James. I think Rygar for NES is great. It's the best Rygar game by far. It's better than the arcade game. It's
not
better
that
than the PS2 game. It is definitely better than the Wii game.
Yeah. I also really enjoyed for Sega anything, pretty much Alex Kidd. I really like the Alex Kidd games.
Rocket Knight.
Rocket Knight's awesome.
Rocket Knight, yeah. That you'd have to kind of, I mean, apart from the new one that's downloadable, like at the moment you'd have to go to eBay for that because we still haven't got any of those games for Genesis or Super Nintendo on Virtual Console.
Rocket Knight is great. And Chameleon Kid, I think, is pretty good. And that's on Virtual Console. It has like 100 levels in it, so there's plenty of content. And it's pretty well made. So anyway, how's that? We just gave you like 30 games to go look up.
And you're lost. Play them all now. Lost track of all of them.
Hopefully we threw something out there that you've never heard of and that you will fall in love with. So thanks for the question, Nathan. The last letter is from David G. right here in Colorado, who writes, "While I have played almost every great franchise from Nintendo, including Mario, Zelda, Metroid, Star Fox, even Kid Icarus, I never really considered getting into F-Zero or Pikmin. I was wondering if each of you guys could provide me with reasons to experience either of these two franchises, or reasons not to."
Well, Nintendo hasn't been providing you many reasons to play these franchises recently, have they?
No. It's the new Play Control Pikmin.
Yeah, but that's about it, because otherwise, it's since 2004, Pikmin 2, and in terms of console F-Zero games, you're going back to 2003 for F-Zero GX.
F-Zero Rage X.
Yeah.
there were the GBA games that came out after that, I think.
The ones based on the cartoon.
Yeah, the anime in Japan. So, but obviously, that was quite a while ago. GBA. It's another one of those really weird things, like, you know, why the hell hasn't there been an F-Zero on DS?
Or Wii, or in general.
But I'm just saying, you have three of them on GBA.
And only one of them is like an official mainline one.
And it's like, no, we can't be bothered to do that anymore. So weird what's happened to F-Zero as a franchise. But of course, you've still got, you know, F-Zero X on the Virtual Console. That might probably be the best entry point for F-Zero,
I think. Yeah, and it's $10. It's really good. F-Zero X is really good.
It's certainly a better entry point than GX. Which GX is a fine game, but GX will make you cry.
It's a fantastic game. I adore it. I think it's one of the really outstanding, of all the different takes on Nintendo's franchises on GameCube, that's the pinnacle.
But it is
extremely hard.
Yeah, it is not a game for F-Zero virgins, or as we call them, F-virgins.
Yeah, if you like the N64 one, then you can maybe upgrade. I think the original Super Nintendo F-Zero it still holds up really well, too, and that's also on Virtual Console for $8.
It's also in every cheap hotel you've ever stayed in, ever.
That's a great point. That's a great point. On those damn hotel TV things.
Oh,
with the
God.
Crappy controller.
When I got overnight delayed in Detroit, it had one of those in there. I'm like, I'm tempted to do this and then send the bill to Delta and see if they'll pay it. pay by the hour to play F-Zero SNES.
Playing it with a N64 controller, most likely.
Yes.
But, I guess, in general, as far as a sort of Nintendo racing game goes, you know, F-Zero is a lot less sort of screwy, you know, than most of the, like, Mario Kart or anything like that.
Right.
Well, conventionally screwy, at least, yeah.
I mean, it's the thing you play that for is it's more of an actual, you know, legitimate racing game. It's still sci-fi. With F-Zero X, you've kind of got just the craziness of going up against 29 other cars.
Mm-hmm.
And the speed, obviously, is always the thing with F-Zero. If you want to play a racing game that is fast, this is the one to go with.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, F-Zero, it's just one of those Nintendo franchises that certainly there are other games that imitate F-Zero or just...
Tube Sliders!
Very simple.
Okay. That's my favorite.
I can't believe you remember
ever.
Tube Sliders.
How can you forget Tube Sliders with a name like Tube Sliders?
But, you know, there are a lot of futuristic racing games on the market on every platform. So F-Zero, it's not unique in that sense, but I think it totally hangs up there with the best of the Wipeout series or anything else that you find on any other system. It's really, really, really good. And it's the kind of game that, you know, you might not expect Nintendo would make a really fast, difficult racing game that people who play other systems will envy. I don't know. It's too bad that they haven't made one in so long. As for Pikmin is a very Nintendo-style take on strategy games, on real-time strategy games. So if you've ever tried StarCraft, Warcraft, Age of Empires, Command and Conquer, things like that. You didn't like them, or you found they were too hard or too intimidating, too complicated. Pikmin is it's not a dumbed down way to do it. It's just streamlined, and it has a lot more personality than any of those games.
Resource management is not important.
Yeah.
I mean, it's there, but it's not.
It's not a huge component.
And my favorite part about the Pikmin games is not just the strategy, it's not just the combat. I love the puzzle aspects of it, which you don't really get in any other real-time strategy game. So it's definitely a unique Nintendo take on a familiar genre, and it's really, really, really good. And, it's the only, let's say, traditional kind of game that Nintendo has spawned into a new franchise in the past 12 years.
Yes.
So, and they've kind of said that recently. They were like, I think Miyamoto was like, it's time for me to make a new franchise. Like, no shit. Pikmin was the last one. I don't want to discount Brain Training and Wii Sports and Nintendogs, but those aren't really character-based.
It's not just stuff like that, though, but I mean, like, to be fair, I mean, WarioWare is its own franchise. It's got fuck all to do with anything Wario's ever been in before.
Right.
He's greedy. That's basically it. He's greedy.
In terms of making new characters, it's been a long time, and Pikmin...
They made Mona. Come on. One thing that Pikmin did give us, though, is it gave us a couple Wii games that are heavily leveraged on it, but aren't it.
Little King Story.
Yeah, Little King Story is Pikmin, but with this very, very dark sense of humor and, like, the cutest take on both cultural and ethnic imperialism you'll ever find.
Yeah. I imagine that you could get new Play Control Pikmin for pretty good price.
It's $19.99. I know that because it's in the deal machine.
It's a wonderful game.
And of course, New Play Control Pikmin 2 is not out in America.
Nor will it ever be.
It's in Japan and Europe. And that's a great game, too. I like the first one better, but I think the second one is great and totally worth having both if you like one or the other. But, Pikmin is a game that there's not a whole lot else that's really quite like it. And so the best way to experience it is just pick one up and try it for yourself. But it is a great game. I guess we've answered that question. I hope you'll actually, David, I hope you'll try both of those series and give them a shot. You know, maybe you won't like them, but, if you like all these other Nintendo franchises, there's a pretty good chance you're going to like these two. They're up to the same level of quality. Anyway, that is going to wrap up listener mail for this week. Again, the address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Write about anything you want to. Write us 10 emails in the same day if you want. Some people do that.
Some people do that.
Sure. We'll try to get to them eventually. But thank you everyone who wrote in with your great questions and comments. Quick programming note. Next week, we're going to wrap up. Really, we're going to do... The Mother 3 retroactive. We haven't really, we kind of started it, but I don't want to say we're wrapping it up. It's not like half and half. We're going to do a real full-blown feature on it and get into the meat of it. It will probably be spoiler heavy, and if you didn't have any intention of playing the game, maybe you'll listen to it anyway because you're not worried about spoilers. But I'm excited to jump into Mother 3, so look forward to that. If you're playing along, please keep playing, and if you haven't yet put your thoughts into the forum thread, go check that out and let us know what you think, and we will be pulling comments out of that thread to read during our discussion and to help give us ideas about what we want to talk about. Want to mention a couple other podcasts going on. There's a new episode of the Newscast out. And, of course, along with Zach, Andy, and Neil, they also have special guest Nathan Mustafa, our new staff member, making his podcast debut. He of the deep voice and good humor. So check that out. Also, a little off topic here, but I was recently on a podcast called Box Office Poison. This is a movie thing. It's a podcast about movies and movie things from Carl Castaneda. And the first episode, the inaugural episode, features Carl, Evan Birchfield, Stan Ferguson, Mike Sklenz, and myself. So a few people you might have heard of before, depending on how long you've been listening to our little show. And we talk about a whole lot of movies. There's like 25 minutes on Inception, and then our movie of the month was North by Northwest, the Hitchcock take on James Bond, basically. And then we talk about a whole lot of stuff in between, and I even do a sort of misguided take on a scene from Glengarry Glen Ross where I play Alec Baldwin and say some things that I now cannot take back, but hey, I didn't write it. So check that out. It's on crosstalk.com. That's crosstawk.com, or just search for Box Office Poison on iTunes, and I think it'll come up there as well. So we're going to do that about once a month, and I'm excited because next month it's my time to pick the movie of the month, and we're going to talk about Caligula. So
Lindemann's favorite topic.
If you know anything about Caligula, you know how epic that's going to be. All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks to James, Greg, and John for joining me each and every week right here on Radio Free Nintendo.
Bye-bye.
Later.
See ya.
I haven't looked at this, John. Did he unseal it?
Yep. Good. It was actually a 15-year-old game that was completely sealed. So
I can't stand people who buy games and leave them sealed for like 20 years. It's so stupid. Play your games. Play your games.
If someone hadn't done that, Neil wouldn't be doing it now.
True.
Well, he wouldn't be unsealing it. He might still be playing it. He wouldn't have paid so much for it.
Well, I mean, to be honest, I'd already paid that much for it anyway because there's like more copies of Teller or Boxer than there are Virtual Boys in existence. So there is a baseball game for the Virtual Boy where if you go on eBay, you have to buy them in like packs of three sealed because they made like 8,600,000 copies of this game and only sold like 110 Virtual Boys. So when I go on Virtual Boy hunts every so often, it's just inundated with somebody selling you five packs of this fucking game. I'm like, I don't need five copies of this game. I'll buy one just so I can say I'm the proud owner of one millionth of the supply of this game.
They should grind them up and use them as fertilizer for the ET flower beds.